Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Just a quick note that today's episode is going to be a rerun. The next season of the Psychology Podcast will begin later this year. I haven't taken any break in 5 years of doing this podcast, so I thought it was about time to take a step back and think about how I can make this a better experience for you all. Until then, enjoy these episodes from our archives.
Thanks so much for making time. I know you're extremely busy.
My pleasure. Completely.
We have a mutual friend, Josh Whiteskin, who I've known for quite a long time, who always talks about
awesome.
You.
I was just texting with him about 15 minutes ago.
Oh my gosh. Well, tell him you're talking to Scott Kaufman.
I will. That's very funny. Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah. So you probably get like lots of the same kinds of questions. So I thought I'd, you know, try to take this to another higher level, because in some ways we've had different, we've had like parallel paths. So I've studied the science of high performance, the science of greatness, all this stuff, my entire career. And you've been in the trenches, right? You've really been doing this firsthand. I was the last research assistant of Herb Simon as an undergraduate, and I was mentored by Randy Palish. And I noticed that both of these individuals are people that that you talk about in your own work. Right?
Yeah. I've Randy Palish, just to make sure I'm getting it right. That's the last lecture, yeah. Right? I mean, he's obviously done more than that. So I have his. We can talk about that, but I have his book face out in my living room, so I see it every day.
That is so cool. Yeah. I took his usability design course at Carnegie Mellon.
No kidding.
Yeah,
very cool.
Really great guy, and I learned a lot from him. Yeah, so I've been studying and trying to debunk this this 10,000 hours rule for quite some time in kind of a similar way you have, and I just want to point out how it's different from how others are trying to debunk it. So other people in my field have been trying to debunk the 10,000 hour rule by saying, well, look, Erickson really demotes the value of talent. So, you know, and that they're missing that part of the picture. And I've been arguing, well, no, that's not quite the point there. The point is you can really go up that learning curve really fast, and it's not completely just because of talent. It's because of all these other factors of like really knowing how to learn, knowing how, you know, the role of inspiration I talk about a lot, the role of active learning strategies and things of that nature. And so I read your stuff and I see a lot of commonalities in the sense that you're saying like, look, we can really, we can cut like, you know, 1/10 of the time, you know, to learn some of this stuff. And it's not just because the person who's cutting 1/10, it's just because they're more talented than someone else. So I wanted to directly explicitly point that out, how I think like, you know, our perspectives kind of converge and are actually different from the 10,000 hour myth busters, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Yeah. So I'd love to hear some of your own personal experiences, like what you think are maybe some of the main principles that can help rapidly accelerate up the learning curve despite the, you know, the genes that you're born with.
Yeah, or in spite of the genes you're born with in a lot of cases. So I think that there are a number of factors and they have a lot of interplay. I mean, as you noted, there's the inspiration, the drive, intrinsic motivation or reward or punishment, extrinsic motivation, punishment or reward. But there are a handful of things that I tend to highlight when I'm trying to explain to people why it's possible to say, as I did in my 30s, go from not knowing how to swim, I couldn't swim one lap, to swimming, say, 40 laps in a session within a week to 10 days. And it came down to looking at the assumptions in a given field, the so-called best practices, and then for each of them asking, what if I had to eliminate this? Or what if I did the opposite? So, for instance, a lot of people think of freestyle swimming as I did, which is swimming on top of the water. You kick really hard and you pull to propel yourself through the water. The method that ended up solving all of my problems is called total immersion. And it flips all of that on its head and reexamines the basic sort of flawed assumptions that underlie most swimming instruction. So they have you kick as little as possible because it's an energy drain, it's an energy sink. And they have you focus on alternating from your right side to your left. So you're not swimming on your stomach or chest, as a lot of people think. You're alternating almost as a boat or a vessel from extended fuselage right to extended fuselage left. Very similar to rock climbing in some ways. And everything is focused on effort minimization. And so they will come in and they'll say, all right, if you feel like you're expending a lot of effort, you're getting a good workout, you're doing it incorrectly. Mm-hmm. And it was just such an incredible juxtaposition with everything I'd been shown, including from some very, very high level performers. And so that then brings the second point, which is the best performers are not always the best teachers. And this is particularly true if they've been doing something for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. In some cases, because in the same way that if you or I, or I shouldn't speak for you, but if you take a lot of the people listening to this podcast, they're native English speakers. If you had them try to take the test of English as a foreign language, they might flunk it. Because if you ask them, you know, what's the difference between anything and something? Quick. Like their minds will freeze. They've never actually had to consciously think about what they've been doing.
Oh, yeah, I totally fail that.
Yeah. And similarly, you want to look for a teacher or someone you can emulate. They don't have to be a teacher per se. Someone who has made the most progress in a period of, say, 6 months or 12 months. And so, for instance, if you're trying to learn to dance, there's a woman who recorded her dance improvement over a year in a 1 or 2 minute trailer. And you could try to reach out to someone like that. Or there was a young guy from the UK who wanted to try to become one of the top table tennis, ping pong players in the UK in the span of a year, and he recorded the entire process. So who's going to have more in terms of insight on tight turnarounds? Someone who's done that, or someone who has been sort of following the textbook for 20 years? And I would argue the former. So seeking those types of people out, which is very, very easy, because you can spend a little bit of time on Google and just search for, you know, controversial such and such player, controversial such and such coach, and that will give you the leads that will lead to all sorts of other gold mines. And I think that also there's a misunderstanding from a lot of people who say harp on the 10,000 hour rule, using it as an excuse not even to try. And that is, they view learning or skill acquisition as a linear process. And so if you have an X and Y axis, it's sort of cutting it right down the middle at a 45 degree angle. And I don't think of it that way. And I think most people in the sciences don't. I mean, and this applies to options trading, another thing too, but you have basically, let's just say, and correct me if I'm talking on my ass here, but a sigmoid function, right? So it looks like an S that's been grabbed by the ends and extended a bit. So you have this slow, very gradual ascent, then this hockey stick, which shoots up into the sky, and then a point of diminishing returns, where it's very slow. And that's, say, that very slow point is where I think you get that's where a lot of intelligent grunt work is involved. When you're trying to go from, say, the number five best cellist in such and such symphony to the first seat. Okay, that's a slog right there. I mean, you have to put in a ton of time for each incremental gain. Whereas my goal for people is to just say, look, it's commonly said you have to spend a lifetime learning a language. That's complete BS. I mean, you can become what most people would consider conversationally fluent in almost any language, in my opinion, in 6 months. And absolutely. And I used to consider myself bad at languages, and I've just replicated that too many times for myself and for other people to think otherwise.
You think anyone?
Well, anyone is a big word. I would say the vast majority of people.
Okay.
There are two things I'd say to that. So my job is to show people how to chop off that first point part of the sigmoid curve, or to get to that hockey stick as quickly as possible. Now, when they hit that hockey stick, are they going to be the best in the world? No, they're going to be functionally fluent. And you can get, though, I think, to top 5% in the general population in almost any skill in 6 to 12 months. I've just seen too many examples. And there are two things I'd say to that. Number one is, specific to language learning, based on everything I've seen and research that I've read, I think adults can learn languages far faster than children. Mm-hmm. The reason that they typically don't is because they have mortgages and jobs and obligations, and a choice. It's an option whether they choose to study or not. And if you take a kid and throw them into a kindergarten in a different language, What choice do they have? A, and B, they have no other obligations. So it's more a function of logistics than mental capacity. That's number one. And Hakuta has done some very interesting research here. There's a book called In Other Words, which is a little old, but I think everything I've seen in working with a lot of tech startups would reinforce this. Yeah. I'm getting on my soapbox here because I get all amped up. The second thing is that it's very dangerous to focus on averages and exclude the outliers when it comes to examining peak performance. And so they'll say, well, on average, people in the top 5% sleep X number of hours per night and do this and do this. But the averages can be very misleading. And in the way that, if Bill Gates walks into a bar, the average net worth is, $50 million or something like that. And I remember reading a story by, or it's an anecdote, about Warren Buffett, and he was being sort of harangued by a bunch of efficient market theorists who say, like, the market's incorporated all the information that's available, therefore, blah, blah, blah. And he was saying, well, and they would argue, they're like, well, look, Mr. Buffett, we don't believe in stock picking, and if you had, 10,000 orangutans flipping quarters, eventually, just by sheer chance and probability, you would have 10 who seem to be master coin flippers to get heads all the time, and they would go off and write books about how to flip coins and make tons of money doing that. And that was intended to kill Buffett's argument. He said, well, fine, that's true. He said, but if there's one small place in Omaha that seems to manufacture these magical coin flipping orangutans over and over and over again, if you find a concentration in a peculiar fashion, you should research that. And you can find these kind of mutant factories for all sorts of skills. I mean, whether it's chess, whether it's jujitsu, like the school that's co-owned by a mutual friend of ours, Josh Waitzkin, with Marcelo Garcia, 10-time world champion, you can find these factories. Tennis, they're all out there. You just have to track them down.
Just wanted to take this moment to thank you all for your support of the podcast over the years. It's been a real privilege to do this podcast for y'all. It's been a real labor of love. If you'd like to further support the podcast, I wanted to let you know a few things you could do to help make it a better experience for you all. First, I'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. This would help make the show more prominent on iTunes and increase our listenership. I believe you can subscribe both on your iPhone and on your computer. Second, it'd be great if you could give the show a rating and review in iTunes. I definitely read all the reviews, and they're helpful to others who are thinking about giving the show a listen. Another thing you can do is donate something to the show. Even just the price of a cup of coffee would really help me continue to do this podcast for you all. To donate something, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com and click on the link at the bottom that says Become a Sponsor. So thanks again for your incredible support of the show over the years. You know, I do this show for you all because I truly love sharing my enthusiasm and love of the mind, brain, and creativity, and I really appreciate you joining me on this journey. Okay, now back to the show.
Yeah, so I saw an interview you did a while ago, and you mentioned that you're really interested in the education space, and then you made a call. You said, if anyone, I want to talk to more educators, I want to be in this world. If I can help you at all with that world, that's the world I inhabit, I'm more than happy to help you. Because there's so many deep implications for what you're doing for curriculum and teacher training. And I wonder if you entered that space at all, and if you ever thought about actually creating like some sort of like teacher training curriculum that really can help students learn better and enjoy learning.
First of all, thank you. I appreciate the offer. Secondly, I have looked very deeply, and there are a few observations that I've made and a few experiments and initiatives that I've focused on. So what I realized early on is that I am good at curriculum. I am bad at politics. And fixing certain aspects of public education in the United States are as much a political issue, if not more a political issue, and have a lot to do with paychecks and maintaining the status quo in a lot of ways than it has to do with improving education for kids or even adults in the U.S. Now, that having been said, what I decided to do, living in Silicon Valley as I do and having a lot of involvement with tech startups, decided to focus on trying to use my platform as an Archimedes lever for a couple of startups that I think are developing solutions that are highly scalable. So for instance, there's one called Duolingo. I was one of the first investors in Duolingo. Duolingo offers free language learning tools, and they're very effective. And it was co-created by or co-founded by Luis von Ahn out of Carnegie Mellon, who was a computer science professor and was the creator of reCAPTCHA. So the capture more intelligent CAPTCHA fields, where you have two fields, and you, everyone's seen these, where it's like, fill this out to prove you're not a robot. And the first one they know the answer to, so it's like X, Y, B, you know, hashtag or whatever. And you fill that out. The next one is actually taken out of a book that has been hard to transcribe, that a machine can't read. And so it was used for transcribing books. So it had this altruistic purpose, which is very cool. And that it would use, obviously, it would look at the responses to, say, 1,000 people who saw the same image, and you would get the right answer. So Duolingo, at this point, is educating more people, helping them learn foreign languages for free than the entire U.S. public school system, or the at least the K-12. So it's been a very good investment of time and energy. So it's a lateral approach. The second is called No Red Ink, which is very interesting, that people should check out. And it's flown under the radar, but it's intended to help teachers and number one, students to learn English and English grammar and writing more effectively, which is notoriously difficult to teach and very time consuming to correct. It's a very sleek, elegant solution to a longstanding problem. And they're correcting millions and millions and millions of sentences at a time now. And that has some huge implications for other areas of education and expediting the entire process, helping to automatically create content that appeals to the interests of the students. You know, they would select, I'm interested in Justin Bieber, the Lakers, this, this, and this, and it would help generate content or find content that they're interested in. And that's what they write about, you know, as opposed to, you know, Mary chases Bob with the dog or something like that. So I have mostly focused on technology as an exponentially growing and developing tool for really scaling things effectively. At some point, I'll probably tackle some of the political issues, but quite frankly, that's not my superpower. I'm too impatient and undiplomatic, I think.
But you're not impatient. So, you're interesting. You're an interesting combination of traits in one human. So,
thank you.
Yeah. So you're like, I mean, I write about this. I call creative people messy minds. I say creative people have messy minds because they have this ability to inhabit seemingly contradictory traits in one thing. And they're actually really – creative people are really good at quickly switching between different personality dimensions, right? So you said you're impatient, but you're impatient in the sense that in the, you're existentially impatient. So this is what I'm seeing is that you're existentially impatient. I wouldn't call you impatient. I would call you existentially impatient. You realize you have one life and you want to maximize this life that you live in. And you're probably maximizing this life more than probably anyone on this planet right now.
Trying. One day at a time.
But at the same time, I mean, you do have great reflection, and in the sense that you really follow feedback, so you really can take feedback quickly and use that to do it. And I don't think like everyone has the same. Not everyone's there yet where they're able to really learn from feedback as well. What do you think are some of the obstacles or blocks, maybe mindset blocks, that are stopping people from acquiring feedback so well and then moving forward in their skill development? Is that a fair question?
That's very good. Question. I think there are, of course, different types of feedback. So there's self-generated feedback where, for instance, you record workouts or blood glucose measurements or what, and you start to spot trends and associations, and you can go, oh my God, I didn't realize, as I realized a few days ago, I've been eating fewer than 30 grams of carbs per day for a while to measure ketone concentration in the blood and whatnot. But if you have, for me personally, my carbohydrate tolerance is such that if I consume, say, a kombucha that has 8 grams of carbohydrates, even once in 2 or 3 days, it will screw up my metabolic objectives for like 3 or 4 days, right? The only way I figure that out, though, is by tracking and writing things down. So the first thing would be know thyself, and the way you do that is by determining what measurables you're going to follow. All right, so if you're trying to learn to surf, you're trying to learn to swim, like what are the numbers that you're tracking? And you can make these up, but you can also borrow measurements. So in swimming, I didn't have any measurement until total gen, and you know, I am have this new TV show, the Tim Ferriss Experiment. We did an entire episode on swimming. And since I already had learned how to swim, we took someone who couldn't even really put her head underwater and tried to make her into a open ocean, long distance swimmer freestyle in 3 or 4 days, which was, which was very intense. But the measurement there that you use is strokes per lap. And that tells you how efficient you are. Mm-hmm. So you try to go from, say, 30 strokes per lap down to 20, down to 15. And it's an indicator of energy conservation and efficiency. So similarly, you know, you could find these measurables and choose objectives that way. So that's tracking. In terms of accepting feedback from other people, you need to find teachers who can give you the why and not just the how. So it's very typical. For instance, I refused to learn the alphabet until first grade, and I was fed soap by my kindergarten teacher, which I was not happy about. My mom was even less happy about, because she was like, learn the damn alphabet because I tell you so. And that didn't work for me. So I dug in my heels and I resisted. And I think a lot of people have had this kind of experience with teachers or coaches in positions of authority where you're like, well, wait a second. Like, no, I want to understand why. And you're a 7-year-old talking to a 40-year-old and they want to punch you in the face and they don't give you anything. So it's important to find people who are willing to sit down and explain the why. So you know, Josh Waitzkin, and for those who don't know his name, it's the inspiration for Searching for Bobby Fischer, the book and the movie Considered a Chess Prodigy. So in the TV episode where I was combining learning chess and jiu-jitsu in the same week, which turned out to be a lot to bite off, yeah. And very injury rich for the jiu-jitsu. Josh would say he would explain why he's teaching chess in reverse, right? So instead of starting with openers, like almost everyone does, he's starting with king and pawn versus king to teach deep principles. And he would say, and Josh has said this, but he'd be like, look, we're creating smaller circles. What I mean by that is we're taking the micro, something very small that you can grasp, right? Not too many pieces. We're looking at king and pawn versus king to teach you deep, powerful principles,
right?
Like opposition and so on. So Josh is great at explaining the why, and then you can bear almost any how.
If you can bear his training regimen.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially the jiu-jitsu. I mean, you have to have a certain degree of choke tolerance for that. But
yeah.
I think there's the why. And then,
yeah.
But feedback for me is really, you know, Peter Drucker, the management theorist, very famous business mind and writer, said, what gets measured gets managed. And I think that's true. So until you start measuring, and it can almost be arbitrary. It will affect your behavior. And I remember there was a study done, you might be familiar with the study, I'm blanking on the researchers, but they were looking at whether turning the lights up or down in offices increased work productivity. And what they found was whatever any change they made improved productivity because people knew they were being monitored.
Yeah, well, yeah. It's called the Hawthorne effect.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, so the Hawthorne effect. Good. I can. Thank you. I needed a label. So it's very similar. If I tell someone, look, I'm going to give you a bottle of pills, and they're called placebo magic.
Yeah.
And they're full of, you know, whatever, sawdust. I'm not suggesting people eat sawdust, obviously, but it's inert. And I say, you're going to take one of these before every meal. Chances are they'll probably lose weight because they're just going to be forced with a pattern interrupt to become more conscious of what they do. And that's why if you want to lose weight and you're like, I don't want to try a diet, just take a picture of every meal you have and send it to your fittest friend.
Yes.
Taylor, you know, it's like, hey.
You're getting things from me now.
Yeah, the flash diet, so to speak, works really well.
It's a great idea. You know, I think about positive psychology, and a major tenet of positive psychology is not, you know, achievement is one part of a pillar. You know, the PERMA model, you also have positive experience, positive emotions and relationships. Positive relationships are important. Engagement and meaning in life. All these things are important. And so you hinted that when you talked about success as not just being achievement, but also appreciation. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely.
And so I think it dovetails really nicely with some of the principles of positive psychology. I think to live a life of well-being, not just hedonistic well-being, which is, but really a deeper sense of well-being. There needs to be more than just achievement. So I'd love to riff on that a bit.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that for particularly type A personalities, they like to pat themselves on the back for achievement, but that's almost hardwired. That's your default. I think that's the easy part. And the hard part that I've tried to focus on increasingly, because it is not my natural instinct or sort of reflex, is to pause and appreciate what you've accomplished or what you've done or the things you have in your life, the health of your friends, family, etc., in a very conscious way. Because achievement without appreciation, on a personal level at least, is pretty close to meaningless. And I know money does not fix that because it's too high up Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Right.
money can only really check off the boxes at the lower end.
That's right.
And I know people in SF who have hundreds of millions of dollars who are miserable. And I think partially the drive that allowed them to make that much money is something that prevents them from living in the present state. They're constantly planning for the next big thing, the next big thing, the next big thing. And they always feel like they're losing. Yeah, this is part of the human condition. I mean, whether it's Man's Search for Meaning and Viktor Frankl, looking at a lot of the tech icons of today, the challenges that people face are very similar. And so I have the habit of using it's called the 5-minute journal, but it's effectively a journal with a component that is listing things you are grateful for. And it sounds perhaps very self-helpy.
That's a positive psychology thing.
There's a lot of data to support this practice in terms of self-reported well-being.
Yeah.
And I find that really, I mean, 3 minutes in the morning and 3 minutes at night is enough to have a not just a non-trivial, but I mean a significant impact on my quality of life and sense of well-being.
Yeah.
And feeling of being unrushed, which is kind of ultimate luxury in my mind. And it's also a reason why I read a lot of Stoic philosophy. And I really feel like it's a good operating system for living in high stress environments while keeping things in perspective and not overly emotionally responding to things like a reactive animal. Now, do I always get that right? No, not at all. I mean, I'm a bull in a china shop, I think, most of the time. So we all make mistakes, but hopefully each day a little bit fewer.
How do you define appreciation? Are you talking about – there's all sorts of kinds of appreciation. You can appreciate other people, right? You can appreciate – there's just lots of different shades of appreciation. What do you mean when you use the word?
When I use the word, I'm so glad you asked because I'm so nitpicky with definitions. So this is to be perfectly frank, I think I use it a lot without defining it very clearly. So let me think about the context in which I use it. Success is another really dangerous word. That's really, and happiness. Those are also really.
Let's not use the S really, word.
Really squirrely.
Or the H word. Use the W word. Well done.
So for appreciation, I think for me it is. Simply recognition, recognizing the value of what you have. And that would be my attempt, my stab at a definition. But I mean, when I write things down, it's literally that. And when I write these things down, I actually got this advice from Tony Robbins, who that guy is he's an impressive specimen, I got to say.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of – that guy is a machine.
Powerhouse.
When he puts together these lists for himself – he gave me a great piece of advice, which was, you can write down the big things, so to speak, which are, I'm grateful for the health of my mom and dad, right? I'm grateful for fill in the blank. But he said, I always put in one thing that is very fleeting and seemingly small, like the two clouds I'm looking at past the eucalyptus trees outside my window that I'm looking at right now. And I was like, oh, that's smart. That's really smart to train yourself to be more observant of tiny details. Because the small things are the big things. And if you don't notice the small things, I think that you can have a feeling of being lost, even if you're killing it, even if you're slaying dragons and hitting home runs. So that's
why
that's how I try to think about it.
Mindfulness is obviously can be helpful for that, right?
Huge, huge. And if you know, meditation is a dirty word to you, which it was for me for a very long time, then start with guided meditations. You could use an app like Headspace or Calm, or you could go to samharris.org. Yeah. You know, make it easy. Rig the game so you can win in the beginning.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely promote your show, which is next week. Am I right? It's coming out next week?
Yeah. It launches on the 28th, on the Tuesday. So that's kind of the big day.
Great. We'll get this episode out immediately. I'm very respectful of your time. Taylor just wants to ask you one question. He's a big, sure. big fan of yours. This is my executive producer, Taylor Christ.
Right on. Huge fan. So good to talk to you, Tim. So cool.
Yeah, you too.
Right on, man. So it's something I love so much about your writing is how it focuses people in on what it means to live a good life. You know, I think sitting down with your books gets people to reflect on their values, on their goals, on their priorities, and just how to live a more philosophically satisfying existence. And it's kind of appropriate. We were just talking about this, really. Mm-hmm. Tim, I'm wondering just what would it mean for you, for Tim Ferriss, to have lived a good life, if you were to take a bird's eye view and look back and point at maybe two or three things you've done and just say, like, I did all right. I did okay.
In 30 seconds. Well,
in 30 seconds or less. So I've thought about this and actually took a seminar that focused on a lot of, you know, highfalutin stuff like Aristotle and, you know, the Stoics and whatnot, right. But trying to define the good life. What does that mean? And I think for me, it would come down to, and this is going to sound cheesy, but it's hard not to sound cheesy when you're trying to give an overarching answer to this. But I would say to have loved, been loved, and to have never stopped learning. I think if I check those three boxes, especially the first and the third, then things will turn out just fine. And it's the order is important. The loving, the act of loving others and sort of wrapping gratitude into that and all the layers that includes, I think radiates outward and topples a lot of dominoes that satisfy a lot of needs and ultimately enhances performance and all things in the achievement bucket. So yeah, to love, be loved, and never stop learning. And then in terms of three things I've done, man, hopefully the next three things I do, I suppose. But I want to convince people that to get superhuman results, all you need is a better set of questions and a better toolkit. And I've just seen hundreds and thousands of examples now where, for instance, the 4-hour body comes out and people are like, oh my God, that stuff's crazy. That's insane. Like, I can't do that. Only, you know, that's Tim Ferriss. That's why he can do it. And in every single chapter, whether it's the, you know, breath holding, vertical jump, ultra endurance, fat loss, muscle gain, any of that stuff, I have reader examples that have far outstripped what I've done. And that is my goal. My goal is to hopefully, you know, by the time I leave this planet, create thousands or tens of thousands or more of master world-class learners who in turn can be teachers and pass that skill set and disseminate that to more and more people. I think that's how you get problem solvers and innovators who can really solve and create some interesting things. So that's what I'm aiming for, you know, one book and TV show at a time.
I love it. I wish you all the best, Tim, and thanks. I hope educators listen to your message just as much as business leaders do. So.
Me too, man. So we'll grab some wine or something and jam on that when we meet in person. That would be fun.
I'd love that. All the best to you.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next season for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.